Don't Blink, Season 9, Episode 11, Heaven Sent.
Hello, sweetie. Welcome to Don't Blink, a fan podcast dedicated to Doctor Who. Grab your bow ties, 3D glasses, and sonic screwdriver, and come along for some timey-wimey adventures across the Doctor Who universe. And now, here are your hosts, David and Jeremy.
Well, hello, loyal listener. You're listening to Don't Blink on Golden Spiral Media. I'm David.
And I'm Jeremy.
And this evening we're discussing Series 9, Episode 11, Heaven Sent of Doctor Who. And I've got to say, I didn't really enjoy it, so I don't have much to say. And we'll talk to you all again next week. Okay.
All right, that's all. All right. Yeah, this is actually the penultimate episode. David has been right telling me how much he's absolutely abhorred this episode. And we'll hear more about that in a bit, I suppose. Right, David?
Maybe. Or maybe this was the best thing ever.
Ever.
Oh, my goodness. I love this episode.
All right. Well, I guess since we're already talking about it, what did you rate it?
I'm not even going to put a number on it. It's not fair to the episode. If you were to twist my arm, I'd give it a 10 out of 10, but it was extraordinary. Extraordinary piece of TV.
All right, so it's priceless.
It's absolutely priceless, yep. All
right. Well, I did give it a number. I gave it 10 hell of a birds.
I love it.
That was, I think, my favorite line from this season, maybe.
Yeah, mine too. And the second time I watched this episode, I realized how uplifting this piece of TV is, because the first time you see it, it's dark and very, very strange, but you get that thing the second time round that it's not. It's the reverse. It's the most like positive thing. You know, it takes you 3 billion years, but you will do it if you just keep being that bird.
Yeah, we had a power outage and internet outage in my area, so I've only got to watch it once, and I still kind of have that dark feeling about this episode. I was kind of hoping to see what you could say about kind of the uplifting side on this tonight as well, because I knew that you had mentioned that via text already once to me. So I was kind of hoping to see the opposing views.
Yeah, and because the first time I watched it, it was on Sunday evening, and it was quite late, and I fell asleep straight afterwards, and I did have a somewhat disturbed sleep pattern having watched this episode, because it's a lot. It's a lot more than you think. This kind of dovetails in, I think, maybe to the cast and crew section of the podcast, because this was directed by the director who did Dark Water and Death in Heaven last year, which I think were up until this point two of the darkest Doctor Whos that we'd seen, both I think in terms of the palette that's on screen, but also in terms maybe of the content as well.
Yeah. Those episodes were relatively dark. I mean, we saw a death last year. We saw the results of a death this year. In a way, they kind of mirrored each other with Clara going through a death throughout that death in Heaven, and the Doctor going throughout a death in this episode. They're kind of dealing in their own way with it. We see these results, and in this one, we see quite literally the voices in the Doctor's head, which I thought was brilliant. But yeah, Stephen Moffat wrote it. Rachel Talele did the direction, and we see very similar to what we saw last year with that direction. And the actor, because we didn't have any other actors this week. And I think Peter Capaldi did such a great job. I wanted to give him a shout out again. I mean, he is the 12th Doctor. I looked up his stat. He was born April 14th, 1958. So there's some trivia for you. And I did find out that he voiced the Doctor, I think, in 2015 or 2014, either this year or last year, for Lego Dimensions. And I'm a gamer, and I kind of like the Lego Star Wars games. I was thinking, you know, that'd be an awesome Lego Doctor Who game. That'd be great.
So. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, they've not had much luck with Doctor Who games. I think this one has broken the curse. Yeah. I remember when, because I think, I could be wrong, and our listeners can correct me, but I think that Peter Capaldi really became recognized as a serious actor in Torchwood when he played a role in that. And it showed a side to him that I don't think people realized he had. And I remember the reviews the next day being like, wow, did you see that? That was incredible. Because he was always a very funny guy, but in Torchwood, it really showed a depth. And I don't think I was aware that they hadn't used it fully in Doctor Who until this one. Mm-hmm. And they just gave him such a open canvas to show what he can really do. And it was incredible. It reminded me, there's an incredible film called Magic, which is Anthony Hopkins' I think first major screen role. And it's very similar. He plays a ventriloquist that goes crazy. right. So that's your elevator pitch for a movie. But the idea is that he's a very talented ventriloquist, but, is known to be a bit eccentric. And so his agent sends him out to a cabin to just de-stress, have a vacation. And of course, it's just him and his mannequin. Nothing good happens, but you don't realize that for huge sections of the film, it's just him talking to this dummy called Corky. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And it talks back in a different voice. And so you forget it's one actor putting on a just virtuoso performance. Huh. And that's what I get from this episode. It doesn't feel like one actor. It feels like a whole world of actors in this. And it just, because of the different moods he goes through and so on, it's just extraordinary. I've watched this three times. I've never for 1 minute thought this was only one actor on screen. It's just, I don't know how he does it.
Yeah. It was a stand-up performance. I mean, it was something that kind of had me on the edge of my seat. And you really, like you said, you forget that there's somebody there. You mentioned ventriloquist, and it reminds me of Jeff Dunham and the character Peanut. And it's funny because halfway through his performance, you realize he's talking to a dummy, just like you said. And it's only one person on stage. And this kind of had that feel, just like you said. It was developed in such a way that, I mean, Clara does have this appearance. I'm not even sure if the back of her head was actually the back of Jenna Coleman the whole time, but
I don't think it was either.
It's just been some chick in the audience. I don't know, but
I don't even know that I was a woman. I think it was, yeah, may have been Capaldi actually.
Throw this wig on. So.
Exactly.
They did credit Jenna Coleman, at least on Wikipedia. So,
well, you see her briefly at the end.
See her. Yeah, we see her. You're right.
But I don't think that was her. I think that was a stand-in. Yes. But I think that was maybe part of the thing. Maybe that was done on purpose, like make it look not like her so you don't think she's going to turn around at the end.
Fair enough.
I don't know.
Yeah, I hadn't thought that, but I don't know. So yeah, our actor this week, Peter Capaldi, probably his best performance as the Doctor yet.
Yeah, and, easily.
I hope that other listeners and fans of Doctor Who appreciated it as much as we did, because I have seen some mixed feelings. We did get some feedback from a gentleman named Ian, and he mentions just kind of he enjoyed the episode, and he has a couple questions we'll get to later from him. But one of the things that he mentioned in it was that he's seen a love-hate type feeling about this episode, and I can't imagine not enjoying it.
Yeah, I think critically it was extraordinarily well reviewed, and that's the other thing, is that Doctor Who has been getting a bit knocked about in the ratings recently. I think to the point that although it might not necessarily have felt like it was going to be cancelled, like some big questions were being asked. And so if you're going to like deploy the nuclear option, which is an episode like this, like now is the time. So the critics loved it. They absolutely adored it.
Yeah. So, you know, we adored it. You know, we love Peter Capaldi. Let's get into the episode discussion. And for me, this episode starts off with some very interesting monologue. Just with the doctor saying, as you come into this world, something else is also born. I don't know do we have an official answer on what that's supposed to be, or did you have a theory on that?
I mean, from a sort of an existential perspective, I get what he's saying, that, you know, your death is just being created.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think that maybe that has a double meaning too. So, I don't know. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think that he's...
I thought death was kind of the obvious thing. We kind of see throughout the episode, that's kind of what it seems to deal with. And I don't really have a developed theory on what I'm about to say, but the first line that he has in the episode is, as you come into this world, something else is born. And the last line that he has in this episode is, the hybrid destined to conquer Gallifrey and stand in its ruins is me. So a hybrid is two parts. So if something else is also born when you were born, when you came into the world, I mean, I'm kind of wondering, is this kind of the hybrid? Is he mentioning that at the beginning, or is it death? Is death the hybrid? Is something like that more or less kind of what they're hinting at? They're not telling you, they're not trying to state that that is what it's saying, but it's kind of almost an allusion to what it is saying. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think that's a great analysis. I think you may well be right. And it was, you know, also a fantastic twist at the end. And I think that Moffat has tried to be very M. Night Shyamalan and twisty in his approach to Doctor Who. And often for me, it's not quite worked. But that, it had never occurred to me for a second that he would say, "I am the hybrid," which was great. But it's an incredible, you know, it's an incredible monologue to set things up at the start. Supposedly, if you look closely, some of that monologue is also written on walls, but not in his handwriting. So it's sort of been given to him, which I think represents the episode quite well, because part of this episode is his agency. You know, he is very much in charge and he's been clever and, but he's also being completely undermined at the same time and having his own monologue written by the creature. And it's gotten into his head and he has to recite it, make sense. I mean,
yeah.
But, you know, for me, even from the opening shots, like, it's clear that what you're looking at is something a little bit different. And it's not montage, but it's done in these wonderful series of very moody, beautifully set shots, you know. So you're not just looking at you know, like a monastic room, but also the way that the sunlight is moving on the walls and time is passing, and then it cuts this TV screen, and then there's a fly on it, so it's immediately changed genre, without, you know, and it's just, it's so clever and it's so evocative and rich, and it reminds me. I remember when we were talking about the Rain trailer that a fan made for Doctor Who. It was before Capaldi, and it just had a different palette and tone to it, and saying, "I hope the show looks like that." This looks like that, and this also looks like not Death in Heaven. It looks like the closers to Dark Water to last year. It just has that lush palette, but it's better yet. And just by showing this montage before the credits, you know that you're watching something that's just a little bit different.
Right. Yeah. And the credits, I kind of wanted to bring up here as well. The intro credits, because of what we see in them, what we've seen in them for two seasons. And we've kind of had clues throughout the last couple of seasons with what's going on. One of the things that we see in the credits are cogs and or cog wheels, whatever you want to call them. It's kind of this feel of these mechanical devices. And we see at the beginning of last season in Deep Breath, we see kind of the mechanical robot. At this point, we see these cogs. And to me, this is the ultimate payoff for those credits. It's this, the literal translation of the credits with the time just passing by with the cogs. The credits the whole time have been the confession dial. That's my hypothesis. And we're kind of skipping to the end with that, but when I saw the cogwheels at the beginning of this episode, I saw the castle kind of turn and move. I knew this is the confession dial. I think I may have brought it up last week. If I didn't, I was thinking it, and my wife would tell you guys it's true. I often think things and don't say them, so I might be guilty of that, but I was thinking he might have been teleported into the confession dial, and we see that this week with everything happening, and then he does some drawing and art later, and I knew for a fact this has got to be it, and it was another gratifying payoff at the end for me.
Well, I think we need to get your wife on the show to confirm this, because otherwise this is unsubstantiated retroactive observation.
I'm pretty sure I wouldn't knock myself if it weren't, but yeah.
No, you're right. It hadn't occurred to me. You're right. It's that the titles are the inside of the confession dial, which again wouldn't be particularly interesting if it weren't for the ending and how sinister it is to be stuck in a pocket sized thing for
two billion years.
Yeah. So, but it's such a punchy, perfect, like pre-credit sequence. There's just even something about it, like it's so wonderfully drawn, and then you see the teleportation device that he kind of zaps himself into. And it's a great piece of set design, and it sort of looks very Dalek-y, almost, or those struts that could also be TARDIS-y. And he's just ready to go at the same time. So the music and the sound and everything have set him up to be kind of a victim because of where we left him at the end of the last episode, but he comes in fighting, you know, saying, you know, if you think I'm, you know, watch out.
Yeah, if you think because she's dead, I'm weak, then you don't understand me. And then he talks about how he's the doctor, and he will never ever stop trying to find the person that was responsible for killing her. And I think we definitely see that. We see the never ever stop throughout this episode, and that's kind of the fun thing as well. But yeah, he comes out of this teleport device. I thought it was interesting because it's a teleport device. It's not a transmat that we've seen before. I think a transmat is time travel as well as location. Teleportation is not. I think that point was kind of attempted to be made clear so he wouldn't have been transported in time, just in location. I'm not sure how that's going to end up working regarding where we end up seeing him at the end of the episode, but I think it was kind of a neat point to mention.
Yeah, I assume it sort of takes place outside of time in that way. You know, it's completely relative to the confession dial.
I was wondering if that was the case or not.
It also reminds me a little bit, if you think in terms of that, of the, if you remember the prison ship that they have for the Daleks in Doomsday, which is the,
right.
It's about the size of one Dalek. So it's bigger on the inside. You know, this is also the same, you know.
So. Yeah.
But it's interesting, so I like it. So you come out of the credits, and the Doctor starts just, you know, to walk around the castle, and you already have these TV screens up, which are sort of fuzzing away, and again, it's that very kind of Ring type, you know, horror. And the beats are done so well. Like, why is there a TV screen here? You know, why is it set on empty? And like. Then he looks outside and he sees that it's a castle, and I love the pace of it, and I love that he's sort of narrating it and keeping it. Feels like he's just keeping the narrative slightly ahead of what the viewer is seeing, which I adore.
Yeah, we're not very far behind him for the most part until the very end, when he reveals his ultimate plan. But we see kind of what's going on with him. We see his reactions to the creature across the, I don't even know how far that was. He looks out the window and sees the shade. What do they call him in this? The veil.
The veil, yeah.
Is what they were calling him. And we kind of see this moment. He's not really scared of him yet, but something just kind of stuns the Doctor. He just kind of has this, well, that's interesting kind of moment. And then he runs from the veil, but ends up getting trapped. I thought the door part was very interesting when he goes down that long alley with the windows, and he asks the door to open.
Well, actually, and I will say that when he looks out to see the veil, on the one side you've got that again, this TV screen on channel zero that's just, you know, but on the other side, that's when you see the wall-mounted thing that has the Doctor's monologue on from the start. So your brain is taking all of this stuff in, but you don't realize it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? Because you're focusing on the thing on the other side of the it's there's so much manipulation going on. And I love it. But and I love the door too. It's a strange bit of dialogue where he's like, which is quite sweet in a way, where he's like, you know, people are always knocking, but it's never for you.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting as well that he makes a comment that he used to know this trick when he was young and telepathic. I don't know. I thought that was kind of funny as well. Can't make a psychic link with the door, but somehow he could open doors. So he does. I think that was kind of fun too. Is that a reference to something that we've seen in Classic Who?
No, I mean, I do think that the first Doctor was... but not really. Nothing explicit. No, I think. I mean, there were sort of telepathic exchanges that the Doctors had when they would meet each other. Okay. But in terms of a sort of broader telepathy, I'm not sure. But I guess that's what he's referencing. So that would be William Hartnell, the first Doctor. So that's retro. I like that.
Okay. Well, when he does open the door, he kind of makes a comment to Clara, saying that, you know, I don't know, kind of his Fonzie kind of moment. I don't know if you've ever watched Happy Days, but I probably bring that out way too much. But yeah, he opens the door and there's a wall behind it. And this is the point where we kind of, I don't know, as an audience and as the Doctor kind of begin to see death kind of facing the Doctor and directly.
Yeah, it's a very stark image. It sort of reminds me of the time when Eccleston opens up the police box, and it's just a police box.
Yeah.
And there's nowhere to go. And the doctor basically says, you know, I don't have a plan, which is interesting in hindsight of what happens later. But so that set of doors is shut, but then he goes into, you know, his mind frequently in the TARDIS when he, obstacles are creating themselves. Which is an interesting parallel to me that, you know, he's, so if there's no doors that will open, he will create them in his mind, go inside in his own head and think of the solution. But of course, what he does here is he has a moment of honesty where he says he's afraid. And we see that the creature stops. And this is where we really start to understand a little bit more about what's happening here and why you have this thing following around.
Yeah. The creature stops, the flies that are around it kind of freeze in the air, and he kind of does his little, and knocks one away. I thought that was kind of cute. And gave us a little bit of a lightheartedness in this otherwise relatively dark episode, at least with one watch. But he's kind of, he begins to question what's going on. And then the castle begins to do its maze thing.
Yeah. Now, where have we seen that before? It feels like a familiar image, like a building rearranging itself like a Rubik cube. But I can't for the life of me think where I've seen that.
Other than Inception, there's some things like that, The Matrix, things like that. I can't really think of something outside of cartoons that we've actually seen this visualized before, but I'm sure it's been done before. It doesn't seem like it's a new invention, but I thought they did a really good job with it.
my brain, I was trying to think of, like, you know, was that like Borges or like some kind of like Argentinian or French literature? And you're right, it was probably like a Daffy Duck cartoon. Yes.
Well, you know, they run in a door, come out another door, that sort of thing.
Exactly.
It reminds me of M.C. Escher, things like that. Escher is the artist with the staircase that kind of meet each other, that sort of thing.
Yeah, actually, and Peter Davison's first Doctor Who, the fifth Doctor, is explicitly referencing Escher, and there's a lot of those sets there too. So if we've not referenced that one, maybe that will be classic Who homework. I don't know.
Right. Yeah. Well, I don't know. I'm thinking of actually, now that I have one in my head, there's a video game that I was playing, Warhammer Vermintide. It's a kill things. It's kind of a zombie thing. But they had a level that was designed like Escher, and it was fascinating. You'd run through a door right side up, and then you'd come out sideways. It was weird. It was mind-blowing the first time I ever played that level because it was like, this is awesome. But so we kind of see things in this sense with Doctor Who where it's not quite Escher, but the maze is changing, things are adjusting, and we don't know exactly where it's leading at this time, but ultimately it's leading to room 12. But we stop, I think, first in a bedroom.
Yeah, and you've got that portrait of Clara, which if you look at it, is just so beautifully done, because obviously it's peeling, and that's an incredible piece of sort of, you know, foreshadowing as to the length of time the Doctor spent there. But even the way the painting is weathered, it very subtly looks like she's been crying. It's really interesting, like the paint under her eyes is coming off, and also of course it's representing the fact that she's dead. You know, it's
yeah.
That decay is smart, and of course it's a very sinister thing to have. It's a flaking painting of someone that you've just lost for no good reason. But this is one of the great scenes in the episode where he is pulling off the petals, he's doing the examination with his eyepiece, and this is the callback to last week's Doctor Who, because when the veil comes in and the Doctor jumps through the window, says you didn't see that coming. We're given that very Sherlock Holmesian type.
Yes.
Right. The insight into the Doctor's mind that he's constantly probing and searching and analyzing, so that what he does that looks very confident and easy is in fact very studied. And you can only do it if you're a genius. Well, Clara has been imitating that this season, but she doesn't understand the work that goes into it, the methodology. So last week when she said, oh, this is what the Doctor does. He's just confident. He comes in and says, oh, I'm going to take the death mark. I'll take it. We'll fix it. She doesn't realize that he's got this kind of constant calculation going on in his mind. And yeah, that's what killed her.
Yeah.
And I thought this was a lovely mirroring of that. And I think they're pretty explicit about it. I don't think that's a theory I'm digging out. I mean, they talk about it, don't they?
Yeah. He's very reckless. He seemingly dives out the window. And like you said, he has this all planned, and we see that when we get into his mind. But it's funny because he makes this comment, "Bet you didn't see this coming," or whatever, because you won't see this coming. And he dives out the window. And my first thought was, well, because you said that, they probably did see it coming in some fashion, but I didn't understand exactly where we were going. But then he shows up in the TARDIS. And my first question, verbally, out loud, was, where the heck did he get that?
Right. Well, it goes back to, it literalizes something that I hadn't quite been able to articulate. Do you remember when we had there was the direct, like, fourth wall breaking?
Yes.
Right. In, which episode was it? Where he says, he's doing the Mozart thing, or the Beethoven thing, excuse me. And he's saying, you know, who wrote the Beethoven's Fifth?
Right.
And we you and I had a different take on that, because I really liked it, and you were not so comfortable with him talking straight to the audience. Mm-hmm. And this has scratched the itch that I couldn't quite put my finger on, is that that's all in his head. Do you know what I mean? And so we're now really getting a very literalized version of the Doctor's internal monologue and his thoughts. And so this has all been leading up to that. Like, all of the times that he's either speaking out loud to Clara, giving her his methodology, or to the audience, it's showing that in his brain, in desperate situations, this is who he is, and this is where his mind goes. But he needs, there's something really lovely and adorable about the way that he goes back to the TARDIS, you know, in his mind's eye.
It's home. It's his, in a way, isn't it the Doctor's wife? Isn't that what they call the TARDIS at one point?
That's right.
The name of an episode.
It is. So, I mean,
it's something that he's intimate with. So the TARDIS makes sense, especially if he's been with the TARDIS for 2,000 years. I mean, at this point of the episode, we don't realize how short of a window that really is. But
right.
I mean, he's been with it for quite some time, and I've been married for just over 6 years, and I've been with her for 12. And I can definitely see that being my escape, kind of, in a sense. I don't know if that makes any sense to you or our listeners, but my wife is the one that I want to go to and share everything with. And we see this TARDIS, and we have the best friend, aka Clara, who's dead, kind of there, but the TARDIS is still home. The TARDIS is that comfort zone. So I thought it was kind of neat that he goes there to think. And sets himself up in there. It's kind of made me wonder in the past, when you're in the mind as well, I don't know if our listeners can ever think in other accents, or if their voice always sounds like their voice, you know?
Well, seeing as we're coming up to the end of the series, and so we're being confessional, which is appropriate for this episode. Mm-hmm. I will tell you, genuinely, I've always wondered about this conceit in drama of people, you know, going into these other places in their minds. So, for instance, one thing that you often see is the classic, you know, split personality thing, which gets debated a lot by the psychiatric community. Do people genuinely have split personalities like you see in Hitchcock movies? But I had a situation earlier in the year when you'll laugh, that one of the most painful things that's ever happened to me, it was a very, very extreme pink eye, and it was about as nasty as it gets. And on the way to the ER, I was able to kind of dissociate myself in the same way that the Doctor's going into the TARDIS here. It wasn't quite like that, but it was basically the same thing. That, you know, what's happening to your body is such a bad deal. You can go somewhere else, and it's very tangible. And that's given me a lot more respect for this type of thing. And that's what he's doing. He's like, he knows if he stays in the physical realm when he's making that fall, like, it's not going to work. Mm-hmm. So he just has to go inside his own mind. It's sort of like when you're very, very tired at night. It's called a hypnagogic state. You can almost communicate with your own subconscious quite effectively in a way that you never can during the day. So, and it makes sense to me that would be a way of problem solving. And it seems very Sherlock Holmesian to me that he's doing that. You know, he's able to go inside his own mind, his own memory palace, and sort of, and analyze the situation in a way but it also shows you how desperate he is, that we're not just that he's doing that, but that we're privy to seeing it happen makes you realize what a dire situation he's in.
Yeah. And he does know that he's in a dire situation. He's just jumped out of a room of a building that's pretty tall. I didn't catch the amount of feet or if terminal velocity should have killed him regardless of what he hit, but I wasn't caring about physics. He did make the comment, though, you've got the rest of your life. And I think it's funny. It's like it may just be a couple seconds. So the faster you think, the slower it's going to pass. I thought that was kind of a neat little bit. And then he talks about assume you're going to survive. And we've seen that. That's the theme we've talked about before from the episode The Witch is Familiar, that the doctor always thinks he's going to survive or believes that he will always survive. So we kind of have him doing that. We have that payoff here. He does actually assume this. He can't afford to be scared of dying as he was when he confessed. And he is. We have seen that kind of in a way in the past. But yeah, so we kind of had that wonderful inner tool that's working for him to calculate the fall. We see that the drop of the flower, the drop of the eyepiece, the throwing of the stool to calculate the distance was all kind of in his plan. And I thought that was definitely a fun way to see the counter to Clara from last week that we already mentioned, as well as this time that he gets to actually do all of those calculations while he's in his head.
Yeah, there's also a thing, and I don't know, Mythbusters disproved this, but, you know, it's another planet, so maybe it would work in a slightly different environment, which is that there's a myth about a guy falling off of the Golden Gate Bridge. And for those listeners that don't know, falling into water from any distance, you mentioned terminal velocity, is basically like falling onto cement. I mean, the surface will just, it'll break you. But there's an urban legend that a contractor fell off the Golden Gate Bridge when they were building it, and his tool belt fell off first, and he went to catch it and fell. But because it broke the surface tension of the water, he fell through and survived. And I also kind of feel like that's what the doctor's doing with that stool here. Mm. I think it doesn't mention that he uses to calculate the fall, but it's all the glass and things. And I'm wondering, like, maybe that was also able to help him kind of get through the water, because it's a very difficult thing to do, is to fall into a body of water like that. And then, but then he does, and you get that extraordinary, like, shot of him upside down.
Yes.
And hanging there, and it's so odd. And then you get the shot of the TARDIS powering up on the inside, which is just lovely. There are also quite a few shots. I was on Gallifrey Base, which anyone that follows that website sees me posting here and there. And people have said that there's a number of shots where it looks like the doctor's face looks like an older doctor, like another doctor from the past. And he frequently looks like John Pertwee in this. And I maybe it's a coincidence, but I'm wondering if there's some CGI going on in little places here and there. I'm not sure. Mm. You certainly have a shot of him overlaid with a skull, of course. So I don't know. Maybe.
I hadn't really given that a whole lot of thought, but I don't know. I did like the rebooting. I loved the rebooting, to be honest. I thought that was one of my favorite parts of this episode, was just seeing him, okay, reboot, let's go, reset. And then he wakes up, and then we see the doctor in the water. And I can't remember if he sees what's on the floor of the seabed or not, but we have those skulls just littering everything, and I thought that was pretty powerful. We kind of know at this point that it's pretty grim.
Yeah, it's a beautiful sort of strange image, and the color palette's weird. And it's like such a vast sort of landscape of skulls. You know, it's sort of very sculpted, and I think just in his performance, you get a sense when he comes out of that water that he knows. Or he's getting more of an idea what's going on. And I like that deepening of the narrative without necessarily even saying anything. And I think that it's that stuff. It's the way that the music is used to tell a story in this episode that really sort of makes it work and makes it very watchable and very rewatchable. I think once you start rewatching this, Jeremy, you'll 2, 3, 4 times you pick up stuff that you didn't see the first time. And it's so wonderful and appropriate. Mm-hmm. That something like this, you can go back to and back to and back to.
Yeah. With the one watch that I had, this point of the episode when I'm seeing the skulls, I'm thinking they're actually the people he's responsible for having led to their death. AKA, I thought Clara was the one he was monologuing to at one point in the episode, or something. Like, maybe it was her, and maybe these are the people that he couldn't save, that sort of thing. So I kind of had this theory built up early on with where these skulls came from. I was definitely wrong, and it was a bit more powerful than where I was going, but I would have been happy either way.
Yeah, I like that idea too a lot, though, and that's the kind of thing that you can imagine someone that is trying to influence the Doctor doing. And, and you know, again, when you watch his performance when he comes out of the water, he does, something's changed. I mean, if I fell in a moat full of skulls, I probably would too. But maybe that's what he does think. I don't know. And it's interesting. So the next scene, now we're getting really confessional. The next scene is, so he goes and there's a fireplace burning, and and you see his coat and his boots. Now, I own those boots, that pair. I'm actually wearing them now, funny enough.
No, nice. Okay. And you're working on that coat, right?
The velvet one, yes, I am, yeah. And they're really comfortable boots, I've got to tell you. They're sort of like the Indiana Jones boots. If you ever get the real ones that he wore, they are so comfortable and they'll last you a lifetime. It's worth spending an extra $100 bucks on them. But when I was watching this episode for the first time, I was watching it with my missus, and I was really, at this point, I'm so into the episode, and it's just drawn me in. And it was really weird. I just said, those are my boots. And it felt weird. I'm like, oh no, this is getting really strange.
Yeah. Do you say that? That's my Dalek.
I don't know. No, it's the only time I've ever felt like it really got under my skin. That I'm like, okay. Oh, those are my shoes in front of the fire. That's trouble. Nice. I had to remember, no, it goes the other way around. I brought them because it's on TV. My boots are not on TV.
Well, I mentioned earlier, and we've taken the long way round to get to this point, but I mentioned earlier that I thought, you know, when he says that, bet you won't see this coming, and he jumps out the window, when he gets down to the bottom and he's picking up these clothes, I'm thinking, holy crap, something is happening. Somebody saw it coming. And I thought that was great. Because at this point of the episode, that's kind of where I was hooked. You know, early on was fun. There was a lot of neat things. The cogs making me think this could be definitely the inside of the confession dial. This was the part that kind of grabbed me, the skulls and then finding his clothes. I knew there was going to be a major payoff at the end of this episode. And this was kind of what started to set that into stone for me.
It's also interesting when you think back on the episode that in hindsight, it's easy to think of him just being absolutely like destroyed. Like he just gets as rough a deal as you can ever imagine. But when you watch the episode again, he does spend a major amount of the episode having agency, to reuse my own word, and sort of being in charge and sort of like making things happen and being the, I am the Doctor and you will not destroy me. So at this point, he's still in that mode. He's still on top of the situation in some ways. Even though he's scared, he still thinks he's gonna triumph just by being the Doctor. And I think it's round about this moment that it starts to go pear-shaped, and you think, no, maybe not this time.
And he kind of makes a comment, too. It's a killer puzzle box. Must be Christmas. So we have this kind of, the Doctor sees that it's designed to just torture him and to scare him, but he's still kind of like, oh, okay, this is a challenge. This is something that I can defeat. I think that's interesting. I'm wondering for the Christmas episode if we're going to get a killer puzzle box again. That'd be great. But I don't know. So, yeah, we kind of have an interesting further dialogue that he's having, or monologue. There really isn't much dialogue in this episode, is there?
There's some. And I think, again, that comes from if you think back to Listen, which is my other favorite Capaldi episode, which I think I actually enjoy more than it is. I think this is amazing. I think I maybe enjoy Listen more. I think this is better TV, though. But he does the whole speaking out loud thing where he says conjecture, you know, and that whole thing feels like a setup for this episode.
Oh,
which I love.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It is. I mean, that entire intro to that episode with the chalk and all of that is now in his head. They've set the precedence to assign that to, he's thinking it, he's not actually seeing it or doing it.
Exactly. It's interesting, isn't it? It's like, but it's like such a dark, twisted version of that, you know? It's,
Yeah. But I don't know. He finds a second shovel at this point of the episode. And I guess finally clues in that it's important. He found the first one earlier, makes some comment about he hates gardeners, which I thought was funny.
I do too. I can't help it. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I wish he would have found that shovel later, but or applied it in some sense, but he decided not to and took the really, really long way around. I don't know. So it was interesting that he's kind of having this monologue. Somebody's wanting him to dig, and then he asks Clara, what would she do? And she's like, same as you. I thought that was great because he's answering for her. We know it's all in his head, but it's at the same time, it's just, it's a neat little, I don't know, insight as to who she was trying to be, essentially who she idolized. And ultimately that's what got her killed because she tried to do what the doctor would have done without having the capacity to handle that.
Yeah. I love it. I love it sort of when it goes out, when he goes out into the sort of, you know, the grave site, for a better phrase. And it suddenly feels like getting a Mark Bergman movie where it's like incredibly impressionistic. and you've got the fisheye lens take on, you know, the creature's point of view. But then it does a jump scare where it pops out the door at him. And it actually, oh my God, it made me jump out of my chair. Doctor Who really does jump scares well, but it's a goodie, you know, and it's like, this is constantly all going, you know, and again, it's panning across and you can see the TV screens and the monitors. And it's just all so weird in the best possible way. And of course, actually, having mentioned Ingmar Bergman, just now I think about it, you know, the seventh seal, that's death, isn't it? It's the veil is,
yeah,
you know, very much like that. Aesthetically, yeah. Visually, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you did have that jump scare and he slams the shovel onto the door and he makes a comment that, what, physics of a triangle you lose? I thought that was great. it was hard to understand, but when I got it, I couldn't help but laugh. I mean, yeah, he gets into this grave into death and we see the veil going back to the smaller hole that the doctor saw earlier. To, with all the arrows pointing to it, to this hole where he's digging, and we get to the bottom, and it says, I am in 12, and then the veil pops back out and attacks him. Did you have any thoughts on the I am in 12 at that point of the episode?
No, all I could think about was the Matt Smith one where he's in the hotel, and he goes, remember that one? It was the God Complex, and he goes into room 12 to see his darkest fear. And it's interesting because there was a lot of conjecture about what was in that room, which they never show. So I thought in hindsight, it might've been John Hurt. That was his darkest fear.
Okay.
Which, I mean, he says, of course, who else would it be? Matt Smith amazingly said that when he was acting that scene, he imagined 12 nooses hanging from the ceiling or 11 and 10 of them had his predecessors hanging from them. And the 11th one was empty, which is extraordinary. But now, having seen this episode, I wonder, in that room, was it not the veil? Or the old lady that he saw on Gallifrey when he was a kid? I don't know. What did you think when you saw that?
Yeah, I thought I am in 12, I thought that meant that the doctor was... Or whatever was riding on the grave was in the doctor. You know, I was kind of thinking that I am in 12 was kind of alluding to being inside the doctor. But that's about all I really had thought at that point of the episode.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, it's I think I was so entranced by the sort of the palette of this thing and just the music and the mood of it that I actually wasn't thinking that analytically. So. I applaud you for putting all that together. It's a sort of extraordinarily surreal image of him digging a grave down and finding that message. But I enjoyed it enormously. But then you get to Clara's question on the chalkboard of what makes the creature stop.
Yeah.
And I think at that point you really start to get the sense of what this is and what it's trying to accomplish.
Right. He kind of makes this point. When he's in the grave in this moment of his head with the question that she's writing there. And yeah, does he call it a confession at this point of the episode or does he just say, Oh, man.
You know, I don't recall, but you have that sort of long shot of, yeah. of the castle when you see it, you know, sort of desperately out to sea, and you realize it's an impossible thing. And that's, again, that gives you a sense of dread too, because you think, mm-hmm. hang on, you know that there's something really kind of Hellraiser-y or, you know, really sinister happening, that this is designed to be an unpleasant place. But it does look like a confession dial, that the castle, when you see it at this point. So I think unconsciously it's putting that in your head.
Right, right. So yeah, we kind of get some movement here with the episode, and then he does have to tell another truth to get out of the grave when the veil kind of attacks him. And this truth that he states was, the first one was that he was scared, and this one is that, or he was afraid of dying. And this one is that he was leaving Gallifrey not because he was bored, but because he was scared. Do you think he was scared of anything specific?
Yeah, it's a great moment, because the Doctor's always said, probably since like the Troughton era, he's always said, oh yeah, it was boring, it was a bureaucracy, I needed to explore the universe, and it never quite convinced. And I feel like the original sort of documents that they drew up when they made Doctor Who in the 60s was maybe that he was escaping something. So I really like that they brought that in. I wonder if they will address what he was escaping next week. I suspect that they maybe will, but it was quite a powerful statement to make. So it does undermine a lot of his sort of self-made mythology for him to say that. So again, it's just sort of constantly, you know, working away at your unconscious or your, you know, it's because he's not someone that's often afraid. And it's interesting to hear him. And it's interesting that that was the thing that he raised, you know, that was the truth that he decided to tell.
Right. Yeah. I was actually wondering if it was scared of being the War Doctor or something of that point. He kind of makes the comment that he's the hybrid. He's already destroyed Gallifrey. He's already essentially stood in the ruins of it, if you will. And maybe that's kind of his understanding, that he's the hybrid, is because he knew that he destroyed his home. And in a sense, that was ultimately his destiny at one point. And I think that kind of might be where we're going as well next week. We're kind of going back towards what we saw in Time of the Doctor and Day of the Doctor with Gallifrey.
Yeah, and this brings in an interesting point that I think I'd like to drop in at this juncture, which was the feedback that we were discussing earlier from Ian. He one of his theories was that maybe to some extent the Doctor was not complicit in this, but he was as Ian said, it was the long con.
Yeah, his goal was always to find a way to Gallifrey.
Right, and he sort of maybe didn't know quite how hard it would be, but this is he's playing it a bit more than maybe we think at this point, which would be kind of epic if he'd figured out that that's his way in, that's his way through.
Yeah, that would definitely be interesting. But Ian also kind of asks the question that's on everybody's mind: is how did the confession dial even get to Gallifrey? So by asking the question, if this was the Doctor's plan to get to Gallifrey, well, how did he know it was going to get to Gallifrey? And that might kind of have been answered with the premiere episode of this season with the confession dial, how it can only be opened by Missy. Essentially, that's the one that's his greatest friend. So we kind of see that. I'm expecting Missy to show up next week's episode, being able to open the confession dial, but we really don't know how it got there. I don't think we know for sure how long it's been since he was teleported, if it was all a matter of minutes or moments or not. And we don't know if the confession dial that he gives a shielder was even the real confession dial, because she was able to touch it. And if I recall correctly, Clara wasn't able to touch it, but maybe it's because she tried to open it, not just hold it.
Yeah, there's a lot going on. And I'm actually, after Deep Breath, I was a little bit skeptical about the extra long episodes, because sometimes that felt padded out to me. But I believe next week is a longer episode, as was the season finale last year. And I suspect that will be a really good thing, because I think all of this stuff is going to come in. I think that there's going to be a bunch of flashbacks and, hey, did you catch this? Is and, you know, so on. So, I'm definitely ready for next week. And I think that all these questions that we're talking about, that Ian's talking about, will bear fruit.
Mm. And maybe fruit flies. Oh,
fruit flies.
I don't know if we'll see the flies again.
I mean, were they robot flyers? I assume they were.
They were interesting, regardless. And the flies did show up again 57 minutes later. He's doing this countdown thing once he escapes the veil the second time. And he has another quote here, just talking about how it's the days that the one that you love, if when you lose someone, the day you lose them isn't the worst. It's all the days that they're still dead. And I think we kind of get him contemplating missing Clara, and we kind of get this, in a sense, I don't know if I want to call it foreshadowing, but ultimately the power of that quote juxtaposed with all of the dead doctors in the seabed.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And there is so much of that. It's also, again, as Ian had mentioned, where the doctor talks about the longest month of his life in the Zygon inversion.
Yeah.
And Clara says it was only 5 minutes, and he says, well, I'll be the judge of time.
Right.
So there's so many of these things all kind of, you know, kind of playing in, which I really like. But also at this point in the episode, it changes gear again slightly, and now he's in sort of investigation mode.
Yeah.
Which is sort of, it's interesting. And you see, if you look in his notepad, he's written down what's in the grave quite literally. He's copied out the, in case it's, you know, a palindrome, but like a crossword style, acrostic or something like mm-hmm. that. So that's his mind going again. But you also get that really doomy sense when there's a sort of, you know, a juxtaposition of him eating and then him doing everything that, okay, this is maybe not going the right way.
Right. He's at this point of trying to survive, figure out what's going on. And he's taking these notes. He's working to outsmart, the veil and outsmart the torture chamber that he's in. And, we kind of get this Holmesian feel again. We've had it before just with the how he's counting down, when he's diving, how he's thinking. And we see that throughout the episode in further instances. But we kind of get this mystery going at this point of the episode. And we kind of had a mystery to solve last week, and we have kind of another one to solve this week. And it's where is room 12 and what's in it, essentially, is what we're trying to find out. But I don't know. So we get the doctor kind of traveling around. He ends up back in the teleport chamber where he originated. He came in, and he finds the word bird next to a skull on the ground. This is kind of a clue for us. As a viewer, we really have no idea where this is going. Bird, to me, I was thinking the bird from the previous episode, the one that killed Clara.
Right, right. But it's also so abstract. I mean, I actually wasn't, that part of my brain wasn't even engaged. I was just sort of letting it all
kind of
happen. Yeah. Yeah. People have pointed out, if you watch his performance, that's really when he knows. And that's when he has the sort of the Hamlet Yorick moment where he looks at the skull.
Yes.
And he knows what's going on, and then it all kind of clicks in. And he runs to the wall at this point which is made of the diamond, and he sees the word, home on it, which I think again is a hallucination essentially, isn't it? It's a strange thing because that word is there and then it sort of disappears. It's a very odd thing. And he's seen it through his sonic glasses. So I don't know if that's like a projection from the glasses or if he, yeah, it's, but again, you know, at this point, things are going pear shape for him. And,
yeah.
And he starts to retreat into his own mind at this point as well.
Mm-hmm. He kind of slumps down on this. I think when he looks at it, it's like 20 feet thick of something that's 40 times as hard as diamond. And I'm thinking, lucky him, diamond's pretty brittle from my understanding. It's just good at cutting. But
oh, is that a fact?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
I don't think it can. I think it can be crushed pretty easily. But still, 40 times the strength of diamond probably can't, because that's going to mount up. pretty strongly.
Jeremy's like, I'd have gone for that in 5 minutes.
No, I'd have gone back and gotten the shovel, though. I'd tell you that. Yes. That was one hang-up for me in this episode. And I didn't think it was that big of a deal. I mean, it's just, why use your hand? I kind of had the, have you seen Kill Bill?
No, I haven't.
You have not.
Haven't.
Right. No. There's a scene in the second volume, and spoiler, if you've not seen Kill Bill Volume 2 or Volume 1, I can't remember the exact order, but at one point the main character is buried alive, and the way she gets out is she takes her hand, puts it kind of at a her finger length, so she touches her fingers to the door or to the ceiling of the coffin, whatever she's in underground, and closes her hand and then punches it with her fist. And so it kind of has this meaning behind it. It goes into all of where she learned it and everything like that. But you have her punching this coffin to break it so she can dig herself out of the dirt. Definitely make believe 6 pounds of dirt is probably going to crush you anyway. But it was definitely a fun movie, albeit violent. But the doctor kind of has that moment here for him. And it's just like, there's got to be an easier way than punching rock for billions of years. And I didn't think it was going to take him that long.
Yeah, I mean, it's right. I mean, I suppose in fairness, the thing is right behind him. And then of course, as a metaphor, it's extraordinary. But yeah, I'd have gotten a spade. Just hit I'd use the handle.
Yeah, use something.
Could have shaved a billion years off of that. That's the Enterprise.
Half that time would have been great, but
yeah.
So we get into this room. He's having this conversation. He can't remember. He doesn't. It's all not fair. I think that's kind of what is going on. Why can't he just lose? And then Clara tells him, and I think this is the only time that she actually says something. But says that he's not the only person who's ever lost anyone. And it says that everybody has to deal with it. Get over yourself. Get out of here. You know, win, essentially, is kind of what she says. And I thought that was kind of a fun moment, very similar to the moment I think Clara received with Danny, kind of where in a different sense, where she's kind of facing him getting over his death when he's in the Cyberman. And the doctor's kind of thinking about Claire and at the same time telling himself to get up, just albeit through her voice and the way she would say it. But so he wakes up, he reboots, if you will, back into this room with diamond for I want to call it adamantium. I know that's not it. What is that?
Yeah.
What do they call it in this?
I didn't catch what it was actually called. Yeah.
Asbantium, I think is what it's
okay.
called.
Okay.
400 times tougher, according to Wikipedia. I said 40, so they're saying 400 times thicker, or tougher. So still, anything that's 400 times tougher than diamond is probably going to be really tough. But yeah, we have him wake up, and he's realized the message of the bird at this point. And this is kind of the fun part that begins. The doctor realizes what's going to have to happen, and he tells the veil, "I'm not gonna do this anymore. You know, no more confessions, but I will tell you the truth." And then this is when he begins punching that wall, and I don't know. I think it's very, very interesting that he does this. He starts telling this story instead of this reality, and I didn't quite see where it was going. I did think it was neat that he kind of does the shout out. He mentions Brothers Grimm. We aren't left to piece that together.
Right. It was almost sort of quite Shawshank Redemption in its own way, isn't it? The way he's sort of like chipping through the wall. And that was, I think when I was watching it the first time, I was struck by the grimness, no pun intended, of the Doctor just being absolutely destroyed by the veil, and he's crawling. It takes him a day and a half to get up the stairs and all of that. But then the second time I watched it, I'm like, you know, I'm quite a stubborn person. And I sort of began to relate to it really a little bit more. And then when you, and I again, I didn't quite absorb the fact that he was telling the story sequentially.
Yeah.
As he gets further and further towards breaking the wall, which means he can, it's great. It's such a cool piece of writing that he can give you a little bit extra every single time. I mean, and every single time is probably like 500,000 years, isn't it? But then he breaks through, leaving you with so many questions about what he experienced. Mm-hmm. You know, does it feel to him like he just did it once? I mean, maybe it does.
I would expect that it does, because he doesn't retain the information, the knowledge. He has to go through that every time. That being said, I think he also understands, just by looking at the stars, it's been about 2 billion years at the end of it. And he goes through 8,000, I think, or 12,000 at first. And it increases from there on. And that was one thing when he said it earlier, that it feels like 7,000 years. And when you kind of figure it out, I'm like, oh, I hope they really take advantage of this time element with him realizing how long it's been. And they do. And I was so happy to see that, because I'm like, oh, 12,000 years, it's doubled. He's going to get out now. And then no, he's just barely even shaved the surface.
Yeah.
And, that to me was powerful. You know, it was very, very, very dark, very just grim. I mean, he's going to be doing this forever, in a sense.
Yeah. And it's there's a touch of Greek myth to it, isn't there? There's a touch of Sisyphus or whatever it would be. But the end, when he sort of punches through, is such a great moment, you know. And you think, just that Gallifreyan landscape, just the palette of it, you immediately go, oh.
Right.
Okay.
Well, I kind of had a couple of other thoughts as well. I mean, while you're in this confession dial, why not regen? Is he not going to want to then sacrifice himself for 12? I mean, because he's talking about he'll just regen in a day and a half. Okay, well, regen, then go dig yourself out, cure yourself, and let the doctor go, that kind of thing. I mean, I'm kind of having a hard time that I was having a hard time understanding, why doesn't he do that? And then if you were going to do that, well, why not just go get all the skulls, burn the skulls, use them as energy? Because I'm assuming skull, well, maybe it can't burn. It doesn't burn, does it?
Well, they'd be wet, wouldn't they?
Yeah. But it'll dry. You've got a billion years. I mean,
have you ever tried to burn a wet skull? I have.
Have you seriously?
No.
Okay, about to say.
That would be terrifying.
You, so. no, I mean,
I'm as we speak, I'm sat on a throne of wet skulls.
I'm just thinking, well, if your data is in the hard drive to make that many copies, billions of copies of the doctor, then why couldn't you just use something in a self-regenerating room, say cloth or, you know, anything, and just regen yourself and have a doctor or an army of doctors?
I just have this sort of like Matrix style, like Agent Smith image of like
a thousand doctors,
like beating out the veil and punching their way through the wall. It's a different kind of movie.
Or using bricks or dismantling the wall around the diamond wall. I mean, that probably would have taken a lot less time.
I would have taken about, it would have taken a couple of afternoons.
Yeah. We'll just cut the grout out. We'll be good. I did think it was a little janky that room, the 12th room, was the only room that didn't regen. I think there's a point to that. So I definitely let it slide. The doctor does say he took the long way round, which is a direct connotation to what Matt Smith's doctor says in The Day of the Doctor, that he was going home the long way around. So we have this unification of the two doctors there, and with what they're saying. But so I'm thinking, well, that room was always designed to take that long and not regen, but that still drives me crazy.
I don't know. We'll see. It might be that because it's the outside wall of whatever, you know, whatever is, whatever he was in, like it's the one thing that can't. I would buy that.
Okay. Yeah, I definitely bought it, but I had to justify it personally. But ultimately, we get this story, and I mentioned it earlier in my rating, and you had the shepherd's boy talking about this mountain of pure diamond. It's called the shepherd's boy, and the story, as I recall it, is a little different than that. But the doctor says, throughout these billions of years, we see all of it, but it takes an hour to climb, hour to go around it. Every 100 years, a little bird comes and sharpens its beak on the diamond mountain. And when the entire mountain is chiseled away, the first second of eternity will have passed. And then the doctor kind of talking to, I don't know if he's talking to the veil, to the confession dial or whatever, but he's like, you must think that's a hell of a long time. And the doctor answers it 2 billion years later, or a billion years later and says, I think that's a hell of a bird. I thought that was a good ending.
Yeah, it's very terrific. It's so good. And he's so, the Doctor's so avian himself. Like, sort of, yeah.
Like Peter Capaldi looks avian, is that what you're saying?
Oh, yeah, sure. Okay. Yeah, he looks
like eyebrows.
Bird. Yeah, and just his general, like, sort of birdiness.
I wouldn't have classified that, but okay. Birdiness.
But he's back on Gallifrey now, and I should be grumpy about that, because I really didn't like that they brought it back for Day of the Doctor.
Really?
I thought it sort of undermined who the Doctor was for the first 5 years. If you just like, oh no, it's fine now, don't worry. It's like, your family's dead in a car crash. Oh no, they're not.
He's a time traveler. He deals with that sort of stuff.
Well, yeah, but that was the lovely thing about it, is it was time locked and it was the one thing he couldn't ever, you know. But I feel like he earned it in this, you know.
Yeah.
And he's also, the other thing is, he's clearly angry when he gets onto the Gallifreyan surface. Which, and you think, okay, I'll watch the next episode. I'll probably tune in for the next one. I'll give it an hour of my time. I bet this is going to be good.
Oh, I suppose. Yeah, he's back. I really don't know how it got there. Missy is my only guess that I really have. I'm thinking, wow, what if it really has been a billion years, 2 billion years? That'd be kind of powerful if it took that long just to get him there, and maybe he walks into an empty city, you know, everybody's still dead. But we had the boy, so that's probably not going to play out like I had it in my mind. But the young boy he sends off to find somebody important. I'm wondering how this is all going to end up playing out in the next episode. But
well, have you? So you avoided the next time trailer this week, I'm guessing.
I don't know if there was one.
There was.
Was there? Okay.
Yes, there is.
Then yes, yeah, I successfully avoided it.
Yes. This does answer some of your questions, but I shall. Well, we're recording this due to power outages in Oklahoma on Tuesday, so there's only a few short days to go before you.
Indeed.
Yeah.
And then Star Wars, and then Doctor Who Christmas special. So I should be good for a couple of weeks.
Right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Those things.
I'm looking forward to the finale of this series, the season. I hate calling it a series finale.
It's going to be good. Like I'm more excited for this than I have been in quite a long time. I think probably since. Well, I can't remember. So how about that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, if this episode's a 10 to me, priceless essentially to you. I mean, I'm wondering, how much better can it get? And yeah, we've seen, I think, more fun episodes kind of with Blink and with Listen, just kind of some of the things they do that are fun. But this was really solidly acted, very well directed and written. And I'm looking forward to seeing a strong follow-up to that. I don't believe I'll be let down for sure, but
yeah, I think they're going for broke, and I think the next episode is going to be quite sideways from this. I think that it's not going to be this part two. It's not going to be Heaven Sent part two. Right. So I'm really sort of I'm very keen to watch it. So, oh crikey! Well, it's been quite a long episode for us because I could have talked about this all night. Honestly, I've got
yeah. There's plenty more to talk about.
There is, yeah. And so it's, and tell us, folks, feedback. We'll talk about that in just a moment and give you the address to write in and let us know what you think. Especially if you didn't like it. I don't think that's true. But we'd like to hear from you too if you didn't. Classic Doctor Who homework. I'm going to give you a two-parter. It's a very short one for Classic Doctor Who. And it's called The Edge of Destruction. It's the third ever Doctor Who story with William Hartnell. It's set entirely in the TARDIS, and there are some mind games, which are about the closest kind of comparison I could make to this. It's one of my favorite sort of, bottle episodes of classic Doctor Who. It was done entirely because they ran out of time when they were making the sets for the following episode, which was set, it was Marco Polo, so it was historical. Mm. And they were like, you've just got to do something for 2 weeks. You've got no money. You've got the TARDIS set and the cast members go. And it's beautiful and really creepy. So I love The Edge of Destruction. So have a watch of that if you can. It's on the box set of the first kind of few episodes of the show. And then how do folks contact us, Jeremy, if they would like to give us their thoughts on this or the series or whatever else it is that's on their minds? Your favorite hot dog.
Pick something, I don't know. Give us your feedback, any theories you have on Doctor Who, on what you thought about Capaldi's performance, And you can submit those feedbacks to us at 304-837-2278 or by visiting us at goldenspiralmedia.com/feedback. You can also reach us at Twitter at GSM Podcasts or Facebook at facebook.com/goldenspiralmedia.
And if you're a Doctor Who fan, don't forget to listen to the other shows on the Golden Spiral Network. If you're a Doctor Who fan and you have non-Doctor Who fan friends, don't forget to send them this show and hopefully get them engaged. And next week will be a big week, so we're looking forward to talking to you all about the series finale of Doctor Who. Doesn't time fly?
I think we're going to leave it with there, guys. So until next week, doesn't time fly? Thank you very much, David.
Thanks, Jeremy.
I am the Doctor in Utah and the majestic tale of a madman in a box are used with permission by Silver Screen Records. They're composed by Murray Gold and performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Ben Foster, taken from the original Doctor Who soundtrack, Doctor Who Series 6, available on Silver Screen Records.